It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
Well, you messed it up. I was going to be super lazy and not even bother with the headset. But then I had to go get the headset just in case. And we didn't even need it.
Yeah, it's probably my fault. How are you going to do it without the headset?
It just has the speaker and microphone on the machine.
Oh.
I've been doing that all day.
It doesn't cause problems with, like, cutting off and everything because...
I don't know. We were going to find out. This was going to be an experiment to see if I could be even lazier than I already am. But now I just had to make the effort to plug in a headset.
Sorry.
I had to walk to a different room to get it and everything. It was terrible.
Oh, wow.
Walk through this field of llamas.
Well, they don't look like you just took forever. Like you disturbed them at all. They seem
they're pretty chill.
Yeah, pretty chill.
Sorry, I was getting texts and I've got food coming, so I didn't know if that was a thing, but it's not. It's just people talking about the fact that my wife is home. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat Podcast, the only podcast that knows more about llamas than any other episode it had before. I'm Tony.
And I'm William, and this is episode 479.
Well done. Well
thank you.
Done.
Thank you very much. Positive reinforcement, that's always good.
Yes. All right, let's get this out of the way. Here's how this show works. Excuse me. We have a hat. It is magical in that it has its own email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Folks, some folks, could be more folks, could be the same folks more often, would be great. Write in to that email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com, with little notes, comments, topics, questions, things like that. That thing in the back there is weird. The hat magically transmogrifies those emails into little note cards with the information written on them that manifest physically within the hat itself. We, its socially distancing servants, draw the cards out of the hat at random, read them on the air, talk about them till we're bored. Do that for about an hour. That's the whole show, except the parts that aren't, which is most of it. How has your week been, Dairy Queen?
So this week I read the Dispossessed.
All right.
I hadn't really intended to. There were other things I wanted to get done this week, but for some reason I started it like on the weekend when I wanted to pass the time, and of course if you start you have to.
It's a very compelling, and I can't even like tell you why, because again, like, it's so much like, it's weirdly a compelling plot while being a novel length political diatribe. Like, it's,
yeah, kind of, yeah.
It's very weird. It's like, what happens? Well, I could tell you what happens, and it is interesting, but it's also not the point of most of the book. Like, it's that I have not read a book like, for good or for bad, I have never read a book like that. It was amazing to me.
Well, have you read her other stuff?
A little bit. Not a ton. I read Left Handed Darkness years ago. And
it's not the same kind of thing?
Honestly, Left Handed Darkness and some of the other things are very specifically feminist-based and things like that. And it may be that I'm just used to that more.
Hmm.
This one being a socio-political thing, may admit, like the fact that this was a novel all about economics, and like that it was as compelling as it was for me. But so what did you think?
Well, this is the first thing I've ever read from her. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's kind of like my experience with Lovecraft. You hear so much about this person. They're mentioned in all kinds of things that you read. You might even have read someone's academic treatise on something they wrote. And so you form certain expectations what it's going to be like. And then you read it and you're like, yep, this is pretty much what I expected. In a good way, though. In a good way.
Yeah, no, I'm impressed that that's what you expected.
Oh, yeah, I was like...
I mean, I guess I did tell you, but...
Well, and again...
For me, it was just such a book like I had never experienced. I was shocked.
Oh, well, like I said, it was... These expectations were built over a long time. I mean, I've heard of her forever. And like I said, read... You know, I'm reading an article and someone will use one of her books as an example of something. Usually feminist, though.
Yeah. Because that's...
Not this particular.
Well, and this is one of her earlier ones.
Yeah.
She is one of the great authors that has evolved politically over the time. Because, like, she starts in the 60s, and some of her stuff, nothing's overtly, like, misogynist or anything, but there's stuff in the early days that, viewed through the lens of time and feminism, didn't look as good or begged some questions. And her response was always, you know what, you're right. And in some cases, she wrote sequels that addressed those and things like that. And Dispossessed is a very early book of hers. And it was very popular. But this was back in the days where people weren't talking about her as feminist yet.
Well, I mean, there's some very, what might be called progressive ideas, with a small p, progressive ideas.
Yeah.
But then there are things like, the sexes are compared on a number of occasions, you know, to say, well, men are better at this than women are, women are better at this than men are, kind of stuff.
Yeah. And there is some discussion between the two societies over the point. It felt very surface level to me. I mean, it felt very... I didn't necessarily disagree with, you know, the anarchist view that they should be equal, but I'm like, that seems really basic and not a major focus of the book.
Well, what did you think was the major focus of the book? I mean, to you, what was it broadly, what was she broadly trying to achieve?
I almost want to call it a fable. It's essentially a critique of at the time would have been modern large-scale anarchist society. And I say critique not to say that it is negative about it. It was a very interesting mix. Like, that was the thing. I've never heard someone talk about a society like this unless they were very intentionally making it a utopia or very intentionally talking about how terrible it is. And this one, I feel very much was like, you know what? There's pros and cons and there's things to consider. And there are problems with this idealized society, but there's also problems with the more standard society and things like that. And the interrelationship and the very idea about not just what the society is like, but what people both within and without of the society think it's like.
Yeah. So what you're saying is that when you've seen things like this before, they're either utopian or dystopian.
Basically, yes.
And this tends to try to avoid those.
At the risk of sticking this word on 1960s sci-fi, this felt more realistic.
Well, yeah.
From a social standpoint, it felt more realistic.
Yeah.
And I think, and this is the thing you and I have discussed before, because your ideal anarchism, as comes up all the time, and I think is an incredibly huge distinction from what a lot of mainstream anarchists believe, is the small community sizes. And this is not that. This is an attempt to do it on large scale. And this points to a lot of problems with that, and even points out that it is because of the scale that these problems exist.
Well, right. I mean, this is all based on syndicate flavor anarchism, which you know, I don't have any really fundamental disagreements with, but it's a very specific kind of anarchism that focuses on labor and labor being in control of the means of production. Taking that control away, not just from capitalists, but from the state also.
Yes.
And
it's very, it has a very sort of Marxist feel to me.
A little
except,
bit.
Except I would say post-Marxist, but I mean that temporally, not philosophically. It strikes me as what Marx thought was going to happen after all the stuff he wrote about. Yeah, he never really got into what happens after the proletariat revolts. And I feel like this is what he thought would happen.
No, I think what he thought would happen was, you have this period of time where there's a transition. You've got the workers rise up, and then they're dictatorial for a period of time to fix things.
Yeah.
And then of course they'll just give up all that power, and you'll have almost like an anarchist utopia after that.
Yeah.
That's what he thought would happen.
And this one is interesting because it's not a successful revolution. It's essentially, it becomes a out of court settlement, as it were. It's a revolution that is so annoying that they say, you know what? We'll give you the moon.
If you get
out of here, you can have the moon. And so it's different. Like there's not, especially because they were so isolationist, there's not the victorious and the defeated in the same way in the history of this society.
Yes, and she also adds some other circumstances to kind of help her along with how the society is constructed. And for example, when you read the book, this society is supposed to have existed for 170 years. Not terribly likely. She throws things in like, well, the moon is really hard to live on, so that made them more cohesive than they might otherwise have been. And also, there's this kind of quasi-religious aspect to it.
Yeah, I mean, heavy on the quasi, I think, but yeah.
Well, it seems more philosophical than religious.
But yeah.
They have almost a religious.
There's a dogmatic aspect.
Yes, very good. And I think she thinks those two things together, how difficult the planet is to survive on, and this sort of dogmatic thing, is what helped it last for that long. But I mean, as I was reading it, there were all kinds of things that were talked about as part of the society. And I just over and over doubted that such a society could last 170 years. And probably the biggest thing was, she very frequently, as the narrator and some of the characters actually said this too, would make comments about tribalism. Whenever you see the word tribe or tribal in the story, it's used in the same way you hear it in media now.
Yes.
That it's bad.
Negative. Yes.
Yeah. It's and I don't know any. I can't think of any anarchist type or anarchist philosophy that would think that way. I mean, even if they wanted to do it just like in the book, where they had some fairly largish syndicates and stuff, they wouldn't think that tribes or tribalism was bad. Or
no, I mean, the philosophy bordered on pseudo-Buddhist in this way. Like, the philosophy of this place was very much not concerning oneself with oneself. And tribalism, in that regard, just becomes the next step of that. You need to think about everybody. You don't need to think about yourself, and you certainly don't need to think about just your pals.
I guess.
It's funny, though, going back through it, though, there's also a completely different way I would define this book, which is the life cycle of a particular individual being born and raised in this anarchist society, and how his philosophy how his political philosophy evolves over his lifetime. Because that's one of the things that I found most intriguing is the main character's views on society change a bunch many times in what I feel like are very realistic ways, and in fact ways that you can see in a modern person now.
Yeah.
But I found that interesting.
He remains both an anarchist and a revolutionary through the whole thing.
Yes.
Which is interesting.
They hint at sort of the origins of that, which I think are very much tied to his family and, you know, his, and there's sort of that thing of, this is what I grew up in, so ultimately this is where I stay.
Right, but also a lot of the breakdown of the society, the anarchist society, can be, I don't think the author intended this, but it's pretty clear you can trace some of the problems with the breakdown with the anarchist society to those beliefs about tribes and tribalism.
Oh yeah, well, and they've developed a hegemony. They've developed dogma. They've, like, their version of anarchism is, okay, we set it up the way we want it. Now it's perfect. Don't anybody touch anything.
Right, but it was also seen as a point of progress in the human journey.
Oh yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I think Le Guin, when she wrote this, and certainly the people, you know, in the book, definitely subscribed to that Star Trek kind of philosophy where we were brutes and barbarians, and we got better over time, and this anarchist philosophy is the pinnacle of human progress.
See, you say that, and with the characters, I agree with you, but Le Guin, I'm not sure. I don't think Le Guin has a side here.
I'm not saying she takes the side. I'm saying...
I think I will agree with you. I think that's sort of the version of anarchism that they have, is that belief that human society has evolved to this point.
Yeah, I don't think she's taking a side. In fact, that belief, I don't think belongs to a side. The anarchists thought that about human progress, and I think the statists thought that about progress. Like, it was a very popular thing at the time in 1974 in the United States. Like I said, Star Trek had that notion that we started out brutes and barbarians,
and
they became civilized over time. That's right.
People like to view everything as having an endpoint. So you made it.
When you think that way, and let's put it in the anarchist, even in the anarchist context, when you think that way, you don't think of anarchy and the principles of anarchy as something organic, because that was said in the book. Lots of things were called organic and natural, you know?
Yeah.
But if you think that human beings aren't by nature anarchists, they have to grow into it, they have to evolve or progress into it, then your society, you're going to have certain customs and things that reinforce that with children and reinforce that with other people, but those customs become de facto laws.
Yep, yep.
So it's incompatible to think that, to have the chauvinist attitude about people in earlier times being dumber or meaner or more violent versus now, because if you believe that, you're not going to be able to pull off the anarchist thing.
No, and that plays out in the story.
That's right. That's exactly right.
While not trying to say that things were better off before.
No, that's right. That's right. But I mean, that connection, the author doesn't, and the characters don't draw that connection. That's a connection that the reader can draw.
I feel like the main character gets there a little bit.
Okay.
I feel like his university time especially, I feel like he comes up against that very concept. And all of his attempt of essentially what he has to do to follow his thread of study and all of that. I think it touches on that idea here that, like, we don't have any laws. Why are you telling me I have to do it this way?
Exactly. So, I mean, it really does. It really does challenge. I think the story, again, whether the author intended this or not, I think the story does, in the end, effectively challenge the whole individual versus society thing. That's a false dichotomy. right? So
yeah.
If you start to get collectivist, you're going to get very coercive and tyrannical. But it's also true that if you hyper individualize, you're going to end up with the exact same thing. You've got, what you need is to reject the whole dichotomy and understand that human beings function in groups. That's part of our nature. But those groups do not erase the individual. In fact, those groups need the individual.
Human society, like everything else, is a constantly evolving state.
Yes, that's right.
It's never done.
Yeah, that's another point that he realized was the revolution didn't really end, never ends. And you just have to, and you've got to be vigilant, because, if you form a society like they did, you know, sometimes, and there are ways that you can have sort of groups that are large that are functional, because you don't bulldoze over the smaller factions. So it is possible for larger concerns to get together and for things not to go wrong, as long as you conduct those things in a particular way. But of course, you have to be vigilant, and the smaller factions have to sort of stand up for themselves, right? And have the right to leave without any type of
rock throwing.
Rock throwing. So there are a lot of ways that you have to be vigilant to let it be done. And if you're not, then things, you know, the more these groups clump together and the bigger the groups get, the more they're going to have hierarchies to maintain things, the more the customs are going to turn into de facto laws and rules. And I think the story did a good job of showing how that happens.
It was really nicely played. Like all the troubles we came against made sense to me.
Yeah, I agree.
Like he was confused. And I wasn't confused. I was frustrated on his behalf.
Yeah.
But I was like, I get it.
Yeah.
But then again, I know I'm reading a book.
Right. Well, you were talking about why it was still compelling. I mean, I guess to me, I thought about that too, but I kept getting back to, because Ursula K. Le Guin wrote it. Like this is her thing, right?
Yeah.
This is what she does. It's speculative fiction it's to me, when I was first introduced to the idea of speculative fiction back in college, I didn't know. I mean, we talk about it all the time. I wasn't a fiction guy before I went to college, but at some point I decided, well, I kind of should get into this. And I wanted to get into speculative fiction, hard science fiction in particular. So I asked a bunch of people what I should read. I don't remember her being suggested, by the way, but that's when I read Asimov and all this stuff. And, you know, this was just the kind of stuff I was looking for. Just this kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I know why it's compelling to me, because it's what I want to read in speculative fiction.
Now you know why I kept bugging you. You needed to read it.
It was very good. Every time they talked about tribal things, I did get triggered, but I didn't blame her for that. That's me and the issues I've had these days. And it did happen a few times. And I kind of, you know, my wife probably got tired of me every once in a while, every 20 pages or so. I'm like, oh, she just did it again. Why is she doing that? And sometimes things seem to contradict. Like there was one part where she talked about something. So we're trying to explain something to the anarchists about how the other moon would have the anarchists would mine and then put all that stuff on a ship trade basically with the other moon.
For things by which to live.
Yeah, and the point was made that it would cost them more to do that mining. So they save money or resources or whatever to have the anarchists do it. And it was noted that some of the people had a hard time understanding that concept because without money, they didn't understand the concept of cost, which that's ridiculous. You don't have to have money to understand.
No, but you don't know how their educational system is.
Okay. But then the very next paragraph, it talked about how eager people were to work in the defense area of the defense syndicate. But wait, they're nonviolent. Also, they don't have war. They don't have police. but they totally understand what working in the defense syndicate means and how that's going to work. So I, again, it's like, this isn't,
they taught him that part. They didn't teach him about prisons. I found the prison thing fascinating.
See, I didn't.
The kids playing at prison. I found that very interesting.
Well, to me, but I didn't because, okay. Like, just like the cost example, there's a lot of ways to understand cost without money. You don't have to be really taught about cost. And remember, later on in the book, it talked about how they used ostracism, you know, to control people, to sort of put them in line.
To me, it becomes a thought experiment. To me, your arguments, while completely valid, are kind of like if every sci-fi show you watched, you were like, they wouldn't have gravity on that ship. Like, it's a thought experiment. What if you raised these children so that they didn't have that concept?
But they do. That's my point. They do have it. They have it in other ways. You don't have to have an actual thing called a prison to understand being put somewhere alone, isolated from other people, like you can't understand it. I mean, and not only that, but think about kids in our society. Most kids who don't have a parent who's been in prison, they don't understand the concept of prison. They're just as likely to build a prison and see what it's like as the kids on this planet. Kids in our society aren't any more knowledgeable about prison. They're not. Right. Someone sits them down and talks to them and teaches them about it. Right? I mean, am I wrong?
I guess no. Mostly, you're getting into a tone that is bordering on condescending, and so I'm not really liking the argument.
Oh, I'm not trying to.
You're kind of presenting it as, what idiot would think that this would have worked?
No. I don't mean that at all. I'm just explaining why, when I saw it, it didn't make any sense to me. It seemed like,
I can't explain to you why it was fine with me. I mean, I guess I take it back. Didn't pick up on that, and even now it doesn't bother me, even though you've explained that technically that shouldn't have been possible.
No. Let me back up. I understand it. I could tell, though, that it was supposed to be kind of a thing that kids on this planet might do, that kids on another planet might not do, and that's the part that I can't.
I cannot imagine me and other kids having played that game. Ever. I can't imagine any kids I know ever having played that game, because as soon as we're old enough to make games together, the idea of prison is very clear to us, because our parents have stuck us in our rooms or stuck us in all sorts of places and told us we were not allowed to leave. And one of the conceits of this world is that they theoretically don't do that with the children.
And yet later on the book, they really describe processes that are kind of similar. I mean, similar enough as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, no, I definitely think the world's hypocritical. The society's definitely hypocritical.
Yeah, well, it was just, I mean, things like...
Again, later in the show where all the people were walking on the starships as though they had gravity, they discussed the effect of gravity later in a more realistic way. That still didn't annoy me for the fact that they had gravity on the spaceship. I mean, like... people get nitpicky about science. You get nitpicky about social science, I think.
Oh yeah, no doubt about it.
So this is your version of, like, those lasers wouldn't have made any sound. You're like, that society would never have been that interested in prison.
I'm not, or whatever. And I'm not trying to be that guy. And I'm not saying that it's stupid. I'm just saying this is how I experienced it. That's all I'm saying.
I'm saying you're saying it just like that guy says his thing. So you might want to adjust. I believe you that is not what you intend. I'm saying your tone is absolutely that guy.
Well, and that's probably happening because, as I said before, there were certain parts where she would say something and I'd get really annoyed by it, but I knew it wasn't her. Mm. I knew it was me and the issues I'm having with the world we're living in today. And that's probably sneaking in a little bit as I talk about this, too.
And I also don't get a pass because... I mean, it's not the starships having gravity, but I absolutely have mine, and they tend to be more along the physics line. Or, actually, I do this with every single romantic comedy movie. My version of this is, like, that's not how relationships work.
Yeah.
And I totally have the same tone. I'm like, she absolutely would not go for, no, and he would never, how does that prove your love? What are you, like, all of that shit. That's my version.
And yet people love them.
Oh, yeah. You know? Oh, yeah.
And you don't judge them for that, right?
I really do, heavily. But
well, I don't.
But I understand. But anybody. No, but I absolutely understand.
Okay.
And
okay.
In some ways, I'm probably envious because the truth is, it's really nice to imagine for a little while that love can be this exciting adventure that has a happy ending and everything's good. I'm just incapable of doing that. And some part of my brain is like, that's because you're smarter than everyone else. And that part's a jerk, but it's a very big part of my brain.
What gets me is, I don't think it's stupid. I don't think I'm smarter than anybody else. I'm frustrated today. Again, it has nothing to do with this book. I'm frustrated today with how certain ideas and concepts, well, like the use of that terminology in tribalism as a way to marginalize people, as a shorthand to you know, make it look like a person's ideas are invalid or irrelevant. It's just, some of these, again, and having nothing to do with this book or it's whether it's a good book or quality book or anything else, I'm having issues with a lot of things that are going on today, and those things get triggered by other things. But I mean, I can draw the distinction between the book.
And there are definite parallels. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that borders on jingoism on behalf, well, obviously on behalf of the capitalist society, but also on behalf of the anarchist society in this. There's a lot of, it's from our society, therefore it is good and right. And therefore the other one is wrong. And freedom isn't free, and this is the greatest country in the world.
Well, this is something that Le Guin is famous for doing well, which is, and again, this is the kind of speculative fiction I was looking for the first time I ever decided I was going to get into it, was I want to see someone, write about a planet whose culture is very different, but by writing about this other planet with a different culture, it sort of forces the reader to consider that some of the things that they take for granted in their own culture are cultural, right?
Star Trek. Not,
yeah, well, kind of. I mean, it's like, there's a lot of things.
Every single episode of Next Generation was that exact thing.
True.
It's racism, but this time they're alien something or other. It's sexism, but this time they're sentient rocks. Like, it was always.
No, that's true. But also there were two other messages in Next Gen that always sort of bothered me, which is somehow the humans always ended up looking really good.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Better than everybody else. And also that chauvinistic notion of the older humans are dumber and worse than the present humans. And
doesn't age well. The humans looked better at the time we watched it. Now if you watch it, you're like, yeah, Picard is an ass in this one. Like, that is 100% the wrong thing to have done.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
right.
They I still love them, but yeah, they're a hot mess.
Well, and the whole series is bookended by humanity being on trial.
By
right?
God giving the thumbs up to humanity and its way of life. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like, come on, you guys. But not just any humanity, today's humanity or the future's humanity.
No, and it's the thing that happens. There is an episode of Babylon 5 in first season where there's some festival on the ship. And the whole conceit of Babylon 5 is all the different races are together. And even if they don't like each other, it's a neutral ground and we can learn about each other. So there's this festival where every species is going to demonstrate its species religion. And throughout the episode, we go to different religious ceremonies. And the commander of the station is in charge of the human one, and he's freaked out.
What?
And he eventually figures it out at the very end. And what he does is he brings all the delegates in, and he introduces them to, I think, this Buddhist monk. And they shake his hand, and he's like, this is so-and-so, he's a Buddhist. And then he goes to the next guy, this is so-and-so, he's a Presbyterian. And then you pull back, and there's this long line of like hundreds of different people. And for a split second, I'm like, that's awesome. And then the second second, I'm like, why does every other species just have one fucking religion?
Right, why? Doesn't make any sense.
And it's the concept, I mean, it's the social science version of the single biome planet.
Yep, that's exactly right.
And Star Trek had everybody had it.
Yep.
And we tried to mess with it. You know, Worf was breaking barriers and shit, but no, mostly.
Worf was breaking barriers.
Yeah.
No, but I mean,
getting into print juice.
That's good stuff, you know, that I like when anyone does it. But I mean, I always heard of her as being like one of the best at it. And this book really, I think, proves that to me. I was very impressed. She's a fantastic writer in general. She's just very easy and fun to read.
There is a lot of stuff I read about it that at the time I'm like, this is because it was the 60s. There's stuff where I'm like, things have happened in the world. Research has been done. So there were several things that I'm like, we now know that's not what would happen. But I mean, social science has...
Wasn't it 74?
Was it that late? I thought it was the 60s.
No, I think it was...
Well, if it was the 70s, then who the fuck knows? Because socially speaking, anything went in the fucking 70s. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Everybody was starting a commune and the secret to life was different things. We've spent over half the episode on this book. I feel like we should not anymore.
Okay.
Mostly.
Well, then
I have important things to talk about.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Llamas.
I see the llamas.
I've been going insane this week because my wife left.
Where does she go?
The day after this podcast. So my wife... Remember when my mother-in-law fell and broke her everything? It froze up, so I'm going to assume you don't remember.
You can't hear me?
Now I can hear you. You came back.
Okay. Yeah, I do remember that.
Yes. During that time, one of the cool things my wife did was cook them a shit ton of ready-made meals in Tupperware that they just had to like heat up and filled their freezer with them.
Okay.
So they've been in Virginia Beach this whole time because that's where they were when this all started and we convinced them to stay there in the beach house. Trish said at one point, you know what? Before you get back, I will go to your house and I will do that again. And then you'll be all set. And when you come back, you won't have to go out so much because they're old and shouldn't be doing that.
That's cool.
And they were like, oh, you know, after she's like, no, I want to do this. Oh, you don't have to. And like, oh, that's so nice of you. Okay. Great. Gonna happen. My wife's a saint. Whatever. So the day after our last episode, they're like, okay, it's official. We're coming back next weekend. And Trish is like, oh, shit, I got to do that thing I said. So Trish left Friday afternoon. And we were hoping it would just be a couple days. She might be back Monday, things like that. No, it stretched and stretched and stretched. And she just came back a half hour before we started this podcast.
Oh, wow.
So, and here's the deal. It didn't register to me until about day five. I've been in here with Trish the whole time, except when I went to Oregon, where I was all by myself, except for two factors that were different. One, I had drugs, which can make you feel fun. And two, slightly less important, I was completely cut off, except for the fact that every day I went and saw members of my family up close and personal without fail. Yeah. So it's absolute bullshit to say I was alone.
Yeah, right.
This time, I've been alone. I can't even see the delivery people because we're doing the no-contact delivery and shit like that.
Right.
So it got to me, and I cannot imagine the people that are living by themselves. I got friends and coworkers, and I couldn't, like, it ended up getting canceled because of the weather, but we were going to do a socially distanced get-together thing in somebody's backyard, and I was like, Trish was like, I have to take the car. You're going to miss your thing. I'm like, no, it's fine. I'll just catch a ride with somebody, and it was like 2 hours after she left that I'm like, catching a ride would defeat the purpose of the social distancing.
Yeah, right.
And I tell my friends that, and one of my friends is like, we'll cordon off plastic down in the middle of the car. And I was like, okay, no. I mean, you'd have to sanitize everything. And they're like, no, we haven't been in the car in weeks, so it'd be fine. I'm like, okay, then if you can make an airtight seal between the two halves of your car, that'll probably work. Well, can you do that? And he's like, okay, good point.
If someone had a pickup, you could just ridden in the back.
There you go. But like, and yeah, it got canceled. So yeah, so I've been losing my mind doing that. I've been playing a ridiculous amount of No Man's Sky. I've just topped 60 hours. That game is amazing. That game is as open as any of those Bethesda games, the Fallouts, the Elder Scrolls, but it's in space.
What are you doing? Because I saw you got a trophy for shooting ships, right? So you're like,
yes.
So you are you being like a pirate or something? Or
No. All the ships I have shot were attacking me or were attacking friendly freighters.
Oh, okay.
Because ships just come around and want to fuck you up. Well, okay. There were some that weren't attacking. There were some that were bounties. I'm flying around and they're like, hey, a ship is near you that is wanted. You want to go blow it up? And I was like, sure.
Oh.
Yeah, but I've also, I mean, the things that you get, like, you get trophies, but there's also milestones, which there's way more of those in the game. And it's for everything. How many aliens you speak to, how much you walk around, how many planets you scan, how many words you learn in other languages, all that kind of stuff. I've done some huge quest lines. I've got quite this cool base now, and I'm building all sorts of stuff. I have a ridiculous amount of money, and I need to get a much better ship. I'm working on that. But the problem is you can't just go buy a ship. You basically have to be somewhere, and some computer-controlled person shows up in a ship, and you're like, that ship is awesome. How much can I buy it for?
Right.
And so I haven't been finding awesome ones. I got a freighter that goes around with me. I followed there's so much lore in this game that they've added in things. And I did this whole, we've got three different types of species in this galaxy besides me, which it turns out that I'm sort of something different. That's not a normal species, but the galaxy is filled with these three sentient species. But then there's also these things called the Sentinels, which are these robots, which basically want to stop everybody from... They're basically hyper-environmentalist.
Right.
Like, if you go to a world and try and do anything, they won't kill you. But then there's also the Atlas, which is this bigger thing that you don't know much about, and people just sort of talk about. But then I found Atlas interfaces, which were these huge things the size of a planet that I would go inside and I would try and talk with the Atlas, and it sent me on this whole quest line and things like that.
Right.
And it's just amazing. Just recently I found the grave of another traveler who has wrote down a bunch of stuff, and I'm trying to get clues of that. And that's all in the process of discovering different planets, warping to so many different worlds and things like that. Every system is a little different. The planets are all very different. It's just really fun. And there's the only times I've been unhappy with it, I've realized, is when too many things were happening at once. And I'm like, I need to pick something to focus on, because I just felt sort of overly weighted down by things. And I've done that, and it's been really fun.
Huh.
So I highly recommend that game, especially if you're somebody who likes those open world games, the Elder Scrolls, the Fallouts, things like that. This is the detail level is different because it is so huge and it's procedurally generated. So yes, the space stations all have the same layout. Yes, there's ultimately probably just a few different features, and there's a dozen varieties, and then they mix and match to make the world. So a lot of the worlds look similar, but they all have different like things on them and stuff going on. And it's really just, I love it. It's a great game.
Well, my wife put in quite a few hours back in the day, but I mean, it sounds like some things are different.
It definitely does, because Stu was playing it back in the day. And in fact, he played it so long ago, his save file can't run anymore because the code is so different. But his son plays it, and he sort of plays with his son. But I'm telling him the things that are happening. He's like, there's none of that. I'm like, you have any, like the different planet types. I haven't gone to it yet, but there was a planet type that it was listed as terraforming disaster. I'm like, what the hell does that look like? I was on one that was called a sharded planet, and I didn't know what that meant. And I went down, and sure enough, there were all these just spikes up from everything, and it was just like a dead world.
Oh,
yeah, there's some amazing shit happening. I'm really loving it.
Very cool.
But that's not the biggest thing.
Oh, what's
the biggest thing is the llamas.
I
told you about the llamas, didn't I, before? The llama at the Zoom meeting? I can't have not told you about this. So, farms that have animals, and it's like come and hang out with our animals, that kind of farm.
Yeah.
Are being really screwed because of the pandemic. So they got this idea and they're like, hey, hire us and our animal will show up to your Zoom meeting and hang out. And so the local farm, Prairie Patch Farms up in Shoeyville, is doing this with their llamas. And Trish found, the local news did an article. Trish sent it to me. She's like, you should do this. Because we have meetings that aren't like business meetings. We have our like weekly get together thing.
Yeah.
And so I was like, yeah, I'll do it. And so I did it. And I was telling people, I'm like, there's going to be a llama at this Thursday, at Thursday's like happy hour hangout thing in the morning. And I was really nervous because we didn't hear anything for a while. But then I touched base and it was all fine and everything. And it's free. They accept donations and I donated some money, but I didn't have to. It's free currently. After June 15th, they're going to start charging apparently. But, and so then we did this and they showed up. It was better than I hoped. Not better than I feared. Like my best case version, still better.
Wow.
It was amazing. It was awesome. Some people brought their kids. Some of my coworkers brought their kids and the kids loved it for like 5 minutes. And then the kids were out because it's just a cute animal to look at. Admittedly, she dressed it up. The one llama had a unicorn horn and a bunch of stuff. But that was my worry, was I'm like, it's just going to be, there's just going to be a llama in one of the windows during the Zoom meeting for a half hour. And I'm like, that'll be more. No, she's there. She starts talking about the farm. She's taking questions. I, right off the bat, because this is a thing that bugs me anyway, I'm like, talk to me about the difference between llamas and alpacas. And so she does. And they're all in the camelid family, which includes camels. And she had a chart and everything. And she introduced us to a bunch. We met four llamas and one alpaca. She talked all about them. She talked about raising. People were asking, like, how'd you get into this? And they've only been doing it for like a year. And she talked about that whole thing. The farm is a freaking nature preserve.
Oh.
Like her uncle, they ended up inheriting it through a couple of things, but it goes back to her uncle who was buying up every contiguous patch of land he could to just preserve nature out there.
Sure.
And we got to the truth about the llama spitting, and they do actually spit, but it's certain circumstances and it's super gross. And like the temperament of llamas, and one friend who sort of homestead farms. And so we were talking about what's it like to get a llama. And she was saying they're actually really cheap, but like we learned so much and it was so cool and they were absolutely adorable and everybody had a great time. And we were talking about it over email, like the whole rest of the day. It was just, I highly recommend checking out. Also, big one for me, I can't wait to go. As soon as like I'm comfortable getting out of my house again, I'm dragging Trish and we're going to go. You can go on hikes. They have like group hikes they do, but you can also like, here's the trails, here's a llama on a lead, go have a walk with this llama. You could just walk without a llama too, but why would you do that when you could walk with a llama? It's amazing, absolutely amazing. And I'm super psyched to go for real. And she's really like, this is one of those, she didn't live here, she had a completely different career. But she's loved llamas since she was like a kid. And when they ended up basically taking this farm, they were like, you know what? We could do llama. And they found out, yeah, you can do llamas great. Llamas are remarkably useful animals and remarkably easy and cheap to care for. And these ones are clearly. Also found out you can't ride a llama. No one can ride a llama. Like some of it is a weight thing, but even a kid can't. Their spines aren't built right. They're perfect pack animals. But they're terrible, terrible. It would really fuck them up if you tried to ride one.
That's interesting.
It was all just amazing.
No, you didn't tell me anything about any of this.
I could have sworn I had told you about this. Yeah, because I thought it was hilarious. I was like, yeah, I rented a llama for our Zoom meeting. Yep. But I encourage everybody in the local area, and even not, because it's just interesting, go to prairiepatchfarms.com. Check it out. It's super cool. And it was a great time. We had a great time. Everybody was having a blast. And we learned a bunch of, then I think the kids bailed because it was cute. But at a certain point, it was way better for adults because we were learning things. And everyone in that meeting was like very enthusiastic about it. But the kids bailed because the kids don't give a shit about how they're related to a camel or, you know, how much they eat per year and stuff like that. And their toes, oh my God, look at llama toes. It's not a hoof. It's a soft sole situation, but it's just two toes, and they have these nails that get really long. Looks like freaking talons. It's terrifying.
Isn't that the same with camels? Don't they also have...
They have two toes. I don't know if they... I've not seen the nails on them.
Oh, okay. No.
But yeah, no, it's the same kind of deal. Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah, so that was awesome.
Now, when they asked about the difference between llamas and alpacas... Are alpacas also in the same family?
Everything comes from the common ancestors called the camelid.
Okay.
And there's basically three branches. One that went to camel, including the different types of camel. Yeah. One that went to alpaca, which is both alpaca and llama have their own branches, which include themselves and basically a wild version. And I think the llama's wild cousin is the vicuna, which I know what that is, but didn't realize it was related.
Yeah, I don't know.
And then the alpaca one was something I'd never heard of before. But again, yeah, they're all in that same family.
Okay.
And I definitively figured out how to tell the difference between alpaca and llamas, finally. The ears. There's subtler things, but the ears. Llamas have the sort of banana-shaped ears, like you can see in that picture back there. One of those is an alpaca, and you can't see, but it has more thin triangular-shaped ears.
Oh, okay.
So it was awesome. PrairiePatchFarms.com. Everybody check it out, including you, mister.
And they're in Shoeyville, did you say?
Yeah, they're just up in Shoeyville. She said, we have the trifecta of just unusual. She's like, we technically have a Cedar Rapids address. We are in, like, within city limits of Shoeyville, and we're in Johnson County. She's like, so nobody understands it. That's funny. they've only had it for like a year, and they got five llamas total, and I don't know which llama we weren't seeing, because I know three of them I knew by name, but then because you can go on the website and see all of them, and I'm like, out of these three, I know we only saw two, but I can't remember which two. One of them's really old, and he kept yawning. Also, they got no front teeth on the top.
What? No front teeth on?
No.
Right in the middle there?
Yeah, so it's just this crap down here, and up here is just a hard palate. They got molars because they're herbivores.
Yeah.
But so when you look and you see that the under one that kind of look werewolfy, there's nothing on the top.
Oh.
It's just in the back. And so, yeah, the old one kept yawning, and every time those teeth would just jut out. That's pretty funny. They're all relatively young, except for the one who's like 15, which is – like the end. The lifespan is apparently 15 to 25. So, but he was very distinguished looking.
Distinguished, okay.
Yes. All right. We're running out of time, so we should draw a thing out of the hat.
Okay.
Wonder if my food ever showed up.
Just sitting outside.
No, it legit is, like a half hour ago. That's weird. All right. Let me shuffle. All right. This is from Dave Avid. I have a hunch, I have a psychic premonition that Dave Avid might have signed it with his standard signature. And the hat was like, no, you're Dave Avid. So it still says Dave Avid. If Dave Avid doesn't like that, he should let the hat know for future.
Yeah.
Who or what is the master of your universe and why? Llamas. No, more alpacas. This is a very weird, I mean, it's a cute question, which is the point. But I this is a very interesting one for us because I think you and I, the answer is probably nobody. In a very real sense, you and I have really well established, like to a fault, ego boundaries. Yeah. Which is really bad given our general life philosophies. Like, you wouldn't think we would be that way. But, like, our sense of self, or maybe I should stop speaking for you. My sense of self is such that it is very hard to attach any self-definition to any relationships as a whole. It's my marriage was a huge one, and I do little ones. I try, you know, gaming group, you and stuff. But for the most part, I'm me. And any group I'm a part of, I'm still just me. I'm just hanging out with that group. Not that I don't consider myself defined as that group or with that group. And consequently, the same thing happens for role models and leader figures and heroic figures. I don't attach them. I get temporarily obsessed with certain people, frequently comedians, things like that. Right now, the master of my universe is Brennan Lee Mulligan, who is the DM on all the Dimension 20 stuff. Which, by the way, I started a new campaign. It's called The Unsleeping City, and I wasn't looking forward to it because it's set in real-life New York, but then, like, there's magic behind the scenes or whatever, and he's from New York, and I'm like, oh, this is just going to be a bunch of how cool New York is. It's the most amazing. I'm loving it from jump. They came up with the most creative characters, and their interactions are just incredible. I'm having so much fun. It's hilarious. I'm having such a great time with it. But yeah, Brennan Lee Mulligan, I'm fascinated with him as an actor, as a comedian, as a DM, everything he does, I'm just loving right now. A little bit of a crush on him, I think, currently. I don't think it would last. He and I would not do well together in a relationship, I don't think. But so yeah, I mean, right now, that's probably who the master of my universe is. In like 2 weeks, whatever. Like, it'll be somebody new. A few weeks ago, it was probably Greg Davis.
Who or what, though, the card said, who or what.
Also that.
I mean, I you're right. I when I have relationships with people, even with my family, where I don't, I feel very connected and very much a sense of, you know, identity in that situation. You know, I identify with my family, with my wife, but I don't, I mean, I there's certainly no sense that I lose any sense of my own identity in that. I don't see what good that would do anybody. I mean, like in my relationship with my wife, the whole, I mean, I want to contribute, you know, to that deal. It seems like if I just sort of let myself get subsumed or lost in the whatever of it, it doesn't seem like I would be really giving the relationship my best or my, you know.
And I say now, like, my marriage is an exception. I can sometimes view us as an individual unit within the marriage internally.
Yeah.
Externally, I still always think of us as presenting as two people. Like two independent identities.
Mm. Like, I mean, I see it as both. I mean, all the time. I don't really see one as being against the other, contradicting the other. But it does mean that, like you were saying, there's nobody, no person I tend to feel like I'm in orbit around. I do think there are principles that I hope I'm in orbit around. Like, I want to live according to those principles. I don't always, obviously. I don't know if anyone can perfectly adhere to certain principles, but if there was a what, it would be that set of principles that, you know, or try to, you know, principles that if you adhere to them, they hopefully lead you to be a decent, helpful,
trustworthy. Why do you always have to go around the issues? You're trying to say our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Just say that.
No.
It's faster.
No. No, it's, weirdly, I mean, now that you mention that, I mean, being raised Christian, I was often surrounded by people who would do that, you know, talk about how important Jesus was, or even God in a more general sense. And something about that always sort of rubbed me the wrong way. Like that didn't seem like it was the point. Like, I mean, you know, I believe in God. I have a sense that God exists and I have a relationship with God, but I don't think of God as an entity that wants me to
subsume yourself as, and to just being a cog in his existence.
That's right.
Like, which a lot of denominations, I'm not going to say Christians as a whole, but a lot of specific denominations of Christianity they can think of, not even like passive, like that's, like if I asked them right now, they would say, no, that's literally what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, there's
like,
a lot of Christians
actively believe that.
Yeah, a lot of Christians think that what they're supposed to do is completely empty themselves of all anything.
See, I'm still going to stick with a fair number of specific sects and denominations. I don't even want to say a lot of Christians.
Okay, fair enough. But it's like they, like you're supposed to be a puppet, basically.
Yeah.
And my sense of who God was, and even in the from the Bible, I didn't see that. I saw a creator who wanted you. His creation, whatever, to participate in creation.
Yeah. More accurate to a definition of a parental relationship in a lot of, when you're talking about scripture. And I think a lot of denominations also believe that. Yeah. I just have happened to bump into certain churches that no.
Yeah, yeah.
So even
saying, you know, God as the master or whatever, it's like I don't think of God as wanting me to think like that. I think of God as thinking, look, you can do whatever you want. This is what I would prefer, but you do what you want. And you know, I from all that, from that relationship, it's kind of like a relationship with anybody else. If you have a, like in your relationship with your wife, you want, you don't have
she
to do certain.
Not tell me I can do whatever I want.
No, but I mean, you don't have to do certain things in that relationship. You want to do them, right? It's because that's, I don't know, that's what relationships are like. And in my relationship with God, or I know I don't talk about it very often, but it's that kind of thing. I don't have to do certain things, but I want to do certain things. And those things pretty much amount to those principles I was talking about before that I hope, you know, lead what I would like for everything I do to be according to those principles. I wish I could say I was better at it than I actually am. Hopefully I'm at least making some progress and getting better as time goes on. But I mean, you know, it's those principles, I guess, that I think of as the masters of my universe, but not a personality or a person, because I don't think in those terms.
We are out of time, but I would like to amend my answer. The master of my universe is pork food products. Also, I got to tell you a joke that I thought was I was super proud of the other day. That there's actually a terrible joke that I was super proud of. We finished His Dark Materials, by the way. I don't have a lot to say, but it was good. Although I think we had already done, I think I talked about that last week. So the other day, the super duper Star Wars nerd on my team at work was talking about Clone Wars, the series.
Yeah.
And how there was some, he's like, I love a lot of things. He's like, there's also some really dumb stuff in it. And some of it's because of cartoon. He says at one point in the series, they meet Force gods. And he's like, there's somebody who's essentially the personification of the light side and the personification of the dark side and personification of somebody in the middle. And he's like, and it was really kind of dumb. And also, it's not anything you could ever do in like a live action thing. To which I immediately responded, yes, because Milton Berle and George Burns are dead.
Oh, that's a good one.
And
I like
didn't
it.
Really realize who would play the middle ground, but I'm suddenly now realizing it would be Ray Wise. I think it would definitely be Ray Wise playing the middle.
That's good. That's really good.
All right. On that note, we got to get out of here, people. Tune in again next week. Same bat time, same bat channel. Disclaimer, there's no bats involved because it's a copyright thing, but he's got the hat, so... yeah, and keep writing in themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Go look at prairiepatchfarms.com cool. Website's a little weird. It's a little minimalist in a way that bugged me, but such cool stuff, and they're cool people, and it's awesome. Get them to show up at your Zoom meetings. Even if you're not local, you can do that. And we will talk to you guys next week.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.